You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
We would like to take this chance to clarify for the Tunisian people that the cowardly operation targets Tunisia's economy. And this operation means we have to all unite and stand together to defend our country.
Following today's deadly attack at the heart of Tunisia's tourist industry, we'll ask if the Arab uprising's sole success story is now under threat. Then, 1 year ago today, Russia claimed Crimea as its own. So what have 12 months of Moscow rule done to change the situation on the ground and international opinion? And later on in the programme, India is adopting the Beijing model to train the next generation of journalists. But will the budding journos be taught to report with a critical eye or just toe the party line? We'll have insights on those stories and maybe a couple more right now here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. And our guests today are Xenia Wickett and Quentin Peel. Xenia Wickett is project director of the US project at Chatham House, and Quentin Peel is a former Financial Times foreign editor, columnist and foreign correspondent. Quenya and Xenia, welcome both to the programme. We'll begin with the news unfolding in Tunisia, where at least 19 people, 17 of them tourists, have been killed by gunmen at a museum in the centre of Tunis. The Bardo Museum is one of Tunisia's most popular tourist attractions, and tourism, of course, is a huge industry in the country. Xenia, it's only been a month since Prime Minister Habib Essid's secular Islamist coalition came to power in Tunisia, and we've always seen, as we said at the beginning, that Tunisia as the one success story, if there is one success story from the Arab uprisings. It's obviously too soon to know exactly what this means for Tunisia, but it suggests that there are deeper problems here that haven't yet been addressed.
I think it is too soon to know. We need to know who was behind this attack. There's all sorts of things we can take out of it in terms of capabilities of the police, capabilities of the intelligence services, et cetera, et cetera. But without knowing who instigated this whether it was one of many, there's very little presumption we can make. Is it too soon to tell about Tunisia? Absolutely, more broadly. I mean, look at where it's located, look at what's going on in the region around it. Tunisia is going through, is in a region of enormous upheaval, and its ability to keep itself on a steady path has thus far been incredibly impressive, and we should congratulate it for that. What the future holds, I think, is very uncertain, but it would be almost a surprise to think that this kind of thing weren't going to happen.
Quentin Peel, Tunis has, in the last couple of years, but certainly in recent months, as Libya has collapsed around its ears, become something of a hub for diplomats who are focused on the region as, well, this is the place where we can be safe. This is the place where we can operate properly. Do you think there might be some capitals around the world that will be starting to have second thoughts about that?
Well... there's nowhere else very easy for them to go. They're not all going to pack their bags and go to Israel, I don't think. So I think that they will very much try and hang on in there. The problem is that I think that the sheer brutality and ruthlessness of IS, ISIS, whoever they're up against, and the fact, indeed, as Xenia said, that they're surrounded by Libya. I mean, that closing off the borders and everything is incredibly difficult. And there are lots of hints that this is a response either to the killing of a Tunisian who was leading IS in Libya, or to seizure of arms from jihadi sympathisers in Tunisia. So it's going to be very difficult to control. I'm sure that, if there is a desire on the part of the Americans, the Europeans, to have one success story, they'll do everything they can to help.
The other thing I would add to this is that they've really hit Tunisia where it hurts in its economy. I mean, it's absolutely reliant on tourism. And what we do know, whether you're talking about Tunisia, you're talking about Ukraine, you're talking about Egypt, these countries, you're talking about Afghanistan, these countries cannot be stabilized, cannot be peaceful societies unless there's economic growth. And we know this very, very well. And so steps like that, actions like this, activities like this that really kind of hit the underbelly and that then make it extraordinarily hard to continue those societies with the sufficient growth that you can provide jobs, you can provide education, you can provide infrastructure, et cetera, does make it vastly harder for other people to react. On the other hand, of course, that is an area where the West, where others can actually support.
Okay, I want to leave that there. We're going to look at this in a bit more detail on the Monocle Daily tonight. We'll be speaking to our correspondent in Tunis, Navina Couture. That's at 2200 hours here in London. Let's turn now to Israel. This time yesterday, many media outlets across the world were writing the obituary, or at least preparing it, for Benjamin Netanyahu's political career. The polls seem to suggest that he would at least struggle to draw level with Isaac Herzog's Zionist Union. And yet, Quentin Peel, here we are looking at, I wouldn't say a landslide, because you can't have landslides in Israeli elections, but what is, in the face of it, quite a convincing Netanyahu win.
He's an extraordinary operator, that's absolutely clear. I mean, a fourth time as Prime Minister, not been done before. He was absolutely ruthless, I think, in the way he went around running this election. He was prepared to infuriate President Obama and the US administration by actually going to the US Congress and attacking their policy on Iran. And he moved very clearly to the right in recent days, very tactically, to get the votes into his basket that otherwise were going off into the little right-wing splinter groups. And so he didn't really shift the center of gravity in Israeli politics, but he made sure there was enough in the Likud camp that he will be the first one asked to form a government.
Zanya Wicket, Quentin uses the word ruthless. I mean, there's another word beginning with R which you could use to describe some of the things that Netanyahu said yesterday, in particular when he talked about the fear of Arab voters, which, let's face it, let's not forget, are members of his own country trying to exercise their democratic right to go to the poll. He said, Arab voters are turning out in droves. We're in danger. I mean, can you imagine if, you know, 3 years ago, Mitt Romney had said to his supporters, black voters are turning out in droves. Everyone must come to the polls quickly.
It really is worrying from, you know, when you look at it externally. Essentially, he has said very publicly, and it'd be interesting to know, you know, the polling over the last couple of days had them neck and neck. In fact, had Zionist Union occasionally ahead. And then, of course, Bibi Netanyahu came out with some of the most extreme statements that you just explained. It'd be interesting to know how much did that play in the move of those voters, because it's hard to conceive of how he can bring the country together. I mean, a number of commentators have talked about what you should have is actually a government that brings the two parties together. It's impossible to conceive that that is possible. It is possible to conceive that Netanyahu, the Likud party, will be able to come together across Israel and actually bring all Israelis together, given his comments. And therefore, you know, where is the peace process? Where is engagement? These things are gone for the near term, I think.
Quentin, I'm interested to see how European capitals respond to this, because so far we've had, you know, in the past few months, Sweden has officially recognised Palestine. Lots of other countries in Europe that have been uncomfortable with Netanyahu's policies and his stance towards a peace process have at least been able to grasp that, you know, one final straw that, well, he does still talk about a two-state solution, and he does still say, well, you know, we would negotiate, but we don't have a peace partner. That's crumbled now, hasn't it? So do you see European governments perhaps changing their tune with the Israeli government?
Well, there's certainly going to be no love fest. I mean, he has indeed stopped talking about a two-state solution. He said he doesn't want it anymore. And that's what, in a way, the Europeans and the Americans had really tied their hopes to. So we're back to square one. And I think some of the Europeans are going to be very uncomfortable. Having said which, they've got a lot on their plates at the moment. They've got Russia on their plates at the moment. And that's very much worrying them. They've always tended to say, look, it's up to the Americans to take the lead. So I'm not sure that they're going to come in all guns blazing, to use a rather bad image, perhaps, against Netanyahu. I was quite interested today, though, at one of the early Palestinian responses I heard to the result, which was to say, great, really pleased that it's clear now. It's clear what we're up against. We're not going to have any sort of ambiguity. We know that this is a man who doesn't accept a two-state solution and wants to carry on with the settlement program. So we know what we're up against.
There were also some interesting, I mean, the Union Arab vote was actually far, you know, because the various groups came together, it was far higher than anticipated. Mm. You know, big question, is there now a change in the Arab vote, that people are going to come out, that they're actually going to, in time, and I say underline in time, actually be a force to be reckoned with?
But that also then requires, doesn't it, you know, the centre-left not blocking off the Arabs from any form of coalition, because, you know, Isaac Herzog was very clear saying, oh, well, we're not going to deal with these guys. And that then...
Arabs have thus far said, the Arabs have just far said the same, that well, not going to deal with
they've
the
They've been
two,
a little
the
bit
the
more nuanced
parties.
About it, I think, in terms of sort of whether they deal with the Zionist Union. But it's intriguing, isn't it, Quentin Peel, that you know, here is a potential block of support that the centre-left could perhaps call on in a loose coalition, and yet at the moment they feel we don't want to do it. It's almost as if they are joining with Netanyahu and saying, well, they're not really Israelis.
Yeah, I mean, and it is one of the worrying aspects of the whole thing, I think. I think the Arab Israelis are in a very difficult position, because there is clearly a lot of racism out there that actually would like to see these people either deported, or their miserable little bits of remaining land that they've got actually somehow shunted or closed down. So they're in real trouble. And the fact that they did unite, I think, is actually quite impressive. I mean, they got about 13% of the vote. It's not too bad. And... you know, is there a possibility at the end of the day Netanyahu could be the nationalist who becomes a pragmatist? Well, we haven't seen much evidence of it yet. But
I think we're all hoping for a Nixon goes to China moment. I think that those dreams might have passed. Yeah. Zainu, Quentin talked about how Europe has Russia on its plate. And so that means that they may, as angry as they might be, they may not go in too hard. America, in Obama and John Kerry, they've got the Iran nuclear talks, which, I mean, let's not forget that Europe's involved in that heavily as well. But that, for them, will be a far bigger thing. Do you think that will preclude, that will prevent them from taking a tougher stance?
It is the thing. What we're going to see, I expect, in the coming years is continued engagement and support in both Europe and in the United States for Israel. Because the reality is, this was a legitimately voted in government, and we may not like what it looks like, and we may not like how it plays out. But actually, the reality is, this is what Israelis have voted for, and both Europe and the US will engage as they've always done before. On top of which, on the American side, you have the whole political aspect of it. No American president is going to go against the Israelis. There's a kind of a fundamental link there. But what I do think is going to be very interesting to watch over the coming years is whether there is a more nuanced split in the policy that the European nations have towards Israel and Palestine, and you're beginning to see that, from that of the United States. You know, the recognition of Palestine. Things like this, that in the next 3 or 4 years, particularly with Netanyahu leading, you could see a divergence between the actual policy activities that could be really interesting.
Do you think, Zainu, there's any possibility that within the Obama administration they start to question whether they want to be seen, whether there's a little more nuance appears there, whether they want to be seen as the sole protector of Israel, the United Nations, always making sure that they waive the threat of their veto. Now that this whole fig leaf from Netanyahu has disappeared, And, you know, this pretense that he ever wanted a two-state solution has gone. Surely that puts them in a difficult position.
I don't see that changing anytime soon. You know, if you look at the American political system, you look at the decades of support within the United States, particularly from the evangelicals, for the Jewish lobby, if you will. America is not going to back away from that anytime soon. If you start thinking in decades terms, yes, possibly. But this is not anything that's going to happen in the near term, no.
Okay, let's move on just before we head to a break. It's a year now since Russia claimed Crimea as its own. And today, Vladimir Putin has been celebrating that annexation in a rally outside the Kremlin. Quentin Peel, this is one of those things from the outside. You know, people who aren't involved think, well, look, this was clearly wrong, what happened, the way it went about. But do we have to accept that actually, for the vast majority of people in Crimea, you know, they are far happier being part of Russia than part of Ukraine?
Yes and no. I think it is clear that a vast majority, maybe not, but the greater part of the people there did. It's not a very nice place, Crimea, at the moment. It's a place where people who are in the minorities, particularly the Crimean Tatars, but also pro-Ukrainian people there, are being beaten up, arrested arbitrarily, held in jail, and so on. The rule of law isn't very apparent there. It's years since I've been in Crimea, but when I was, which was in the early 90s, it was one of the last redoubts of old-style communism. There was Lenin was everywhere, and I think there were a few Stalin portraits in some of the people's homes. So it's a real throwback place. And I think that the most important thing of all, though, is that this was a unilateral action by Putin and by Russia, and that's what the Europeans and the Americans cannot accept. Most of all, it's what Angela Merkel cannot accept, that somebody rewrites the post-war borders unilaterally.
They might not be able to accept it, Zenia, but it's happened and no one's doing anything. There is no discussion anywhere in any capital around the world of like, well, we must, you know, what are we going to do to make sure that Russia gives Crimea back?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything that Quentin just said. You know, you are never going to get a Western acceptance of Crimea being Russian land. At the same time, you're extremely unlikely to get any kind of a Western military action to take it back. And when I say extremely unlikely, I think it's just non-existent because you couldn't. It wouldn't work. And the implications of trying it would be severe. What you may find, and again, I mean, I kind of bring it back to economics. As Quentin said, economics is going to play a huge role in Crimea, as it will in much of Ukraine. The Russian government isn't, you know, let's look a year from now or 2 years from now, the Russian government isn't going to be able to fund infrastructure, education, social spending, etc. in Crimea. It's not conjoined with Russia, which elevates costs quite significantly. And so the standard of living in Crimea is likely to drop even from the low levels, relatively speaking, that it is today. And you could actually find yourself in 5 and 10 years actually having a lot of people who right now support being part of Russia saying, this hasn't been so good for us. We were promised a whole load of things that haven't played out. And so you could actually see a change on the ground that is far more effective in many respects than any kind of a military action.
It also depends on Crimea still providing the energy, and yeah, you know. So actually, it's not something that Putin can just say, it's mine, it's a done deal. He's also allied himself, both in the Crimea and in eastern Ukraine, with some very nasty people. Some of these separatists are real pan-Slavic neo-Nazis. I don't know what you'd call them. They are not well-behaved. They're not nice people. But at the end of the day, yes, you're absolutely right. Can it work economically? It's something of an embarrassment to Putin. So he's playing this both ways. Huge popularity in Russia for what he did, and yet it's not sustainable.
Yeah, and it's actually more than an embarrassment. I mean, you know, Putin is having economic challenges. You know, depending on who you talk to, they've got reserves that will last them a year and a half, give or take. This is actually a potential drain on the Russian economy.
But we're saying it's an embarrassment for Putin. We're saying it's, you know, economically potentially disastrous, and already, you know, the Russian economy, as we've seen over the past few months, you know, almost a year now, has been really suffering. And yet that hasn't affected Putin's standing within Russia at all, Quentin, has it?
No, and in fact, he's, if anything, made it worse for ordinary people by actually refusing to import from Europe fruit and veg and apples
and shutting
from
down
Poland.
McDonald's. And...
Yeah. Now, the truth is, he's got a brilliant propaganda operation running. I mean, this is something that we've got to recognise, that the Russian propaganda, the Kremlin's propaganda on this entire operation has been extraordinarily successful, particularly inside Russia. So the story has been sold, you know, this is all because we were being surrounded. It's all a terrible American plot, by the way. The fact is that I'm not sure there are very many Americans who actually really care about what's happening in Ukraine, but Russia wants to believe it is. When Mikhail Khodorkovsky was through London the other day and, in fact, talked to Chatham House, he put it very clearly. What is Putin really after? Not actually to recreate the empire as such. He wants to be back at the top table with America. That's what he really wants to be. It's a dream. It's not going to happen, but that's his ambition.
Do you think that's true, Zonia? Do you think that's what he wants?
I think I would put it a little bit more succinctly even than that, which is Putin wants to stay on top. He wants to stay on top of a country that's on top. And of course, the irony of all of this is the actions that he has pursued over the last year have only served to emphasize the fact that Russia is weakening rather than strengthening. But his media operation, his propaganda operation within Russia has been superlative. And he doesn't care what the rest of the world... That's an exaggeration. He actually does care quite deeply what the rest of the world thinks. He's willing to forego that if he can stay on top and be seen to stay on top with a strong country in the eyes of the Russian people.
We say that his propaganda inside Russia is a success, but in many ways, Quentin, it's been a success outside Russia as well, because, you know, we talk of him as if he is, you know, as if Russia is this great power again, and it's, what is Putin going to do? And, oh, Obama's been weak in the face of Putin, Europe's been weak in the face of Putin. And, you know, Obama was talking about him and saying, well, look, actually, he's a regional power. And there's some truth in that, isn't it?
Well, I said there are certainly people in Europe, both on the far left and the far right, who say, give us, you know, Putin's the guy we respect. So he's actually clearly financing some of these parties like the National Front in France and others. There's Greece trotting off to go and say,
just mean at the extremes of those that support Putin. I'm talking more about those within mainstream political opinion who talk about how their own leaders have been weak in the face of Putin's aggressions.
Yes, I suppose so. Having said that, you've heard me say nice things about Angela Merkel before. Angela Merkel has enormous respect, and not just in Germany, but right across Europe, for being the sort of very careful, very methodical, very peace-loving person that isn't an aggressive, chest-thumping Putin. So I wouldn't go too far in saying he's got respect. I think on the whole, he's got respect from the extremes and not from the middle ground.
OK, we will take a short break when we're back. A couple of more bits and pieces. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Covering everything from Security Council shifts at the United Nations to smart startups in the Hudson Valley, Monocle's New York Bureau's beat can also extend all the way down to Argentina and up and over to Alaska. Ed Stocker is our Bureau Chief in New York.
From business to politics via the arts, we're tapped into what's happening in this fast-paced city across the US and travelling into Latin America.
With one of the biggest beats in our correspondent network, New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker is just as likely to be reporting from Mexico City or Medellin as he is from Manhattan. You can hear his reports across the schedule here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me, Zonia Wickett and Quentin Peel. In September 1961, UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld was travelling to meet the leader of a secessionist movement in Congo when his plane went down over the then British protectorate of Northern Rhodesia. Hammarskjöld was killed, yet the cause of the crash is still highly debated. Was it pilot error, as we were told at the time, or foul play? In 2013, a UN panel concluded that there was persuasive evidence that the aircraft was subjected to some form of attack or threat as it circled to land. The UN is now going to have another go at the investigation. A fresh panel has been assembled. Quentin Peel, it's an old story, but it's one that doesn't go away because it's got all sorts of other connotations about US involvement, possible Belgian involvement. It really matters finding out what happened to Hammarskjöld, doesn't it?
Well, it was at the height of the Cold War. It was, the world was so bitterly divided, and the fact was, I think there was a real suspicion, oh my God, this Nordic guy, you know, is too much of a peacemaker and he's going to allow the left wing to creep in and maybe even take over the Congo. And that suspicion has never gone away. Quite what it proves to show now that he was shot down, that he was murdered in cold blood, I'm not sure. It is a question of justice, I suppose, being seen to be done.
Zainier, it's become clear in recent years that both the US and Belgium at least gave tacit approval to the killing of Patrice Lumumba, who was the Prime Minister of Congo and at the time. If any sort of complicity in the death of Hammarskjöld, you know, the UN Secretary General was to be proven, and that's a very big if, could that actually still be quite damaging more than 50 years on?
I have to say, you know, I think this is pretty dangerous, digging up old history, because it's not clear to me, you know, the reality is whatever they find out, there will still be conspiracy theorists who will believe that America was behind it or Belgium was behind it or the Africans, you know, Congo, et cetera, were behind it. People will still believe that regardless of what evidence comes out.
But surely, even if some evidence, if something can be proved conclusively either way, surely that's a good thing, though, isn't it?
Well, why? I mean, truly, why? I mean, it's, you know, so you believe that in the end you can conclusively prove that, say, Belgium was behind this, hypothetically speaking. Is there going to be anybody that you're going to be able to jail or prosecute at this point, you know, to bring justice? Probably not. At this point, what's it going to do in terms of bilateral relations, in terms of stirring up old memories? None of it's going to be good. And then you're still going to have people that, regardless of what it is that the evidence says, say, well, it really wasn't. It's just a cover up. It's actually somebody else. I kind of asked the question of, you know, I don't know how much this is costing the UN to actually do, but maybe time and energy could be better spent.
But the whole point is it's not going to be conclusive,
yes.
I think.
Yeah.
That is really the problem. All sorts of bits and pieces will come out. And we are living in a conspiracy theory world. I believe passionately in the cock-up theory of history.
Yes.
90% of the time things are done by mistake or whatever. But people are so inclined to believe conspiracies now because they go viral on the internet. And if this comes up with a half-baked conclusion but a few bits of evidence here and there, it is very dangerous, really. Yeah. I'm with Zainier on this. I'm not sure. Sure that so many years afterwards is going to prove anything.
Okay, I disagree with you both. We're going to move on. Now, can a government train journalists without turning them into propagandists? That's the question being raised as Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi announces a new plan to spend $32 million on a new journalism university. It's not going to be like Columbia, though. Their inspiration for a successful model is Beijing. Quentin, is this a way to train journalists?
I think it's ghastly, absolutely horrifying. And I'm appalled that a country like India, which has a fantastic tradition of an outspoken and independent press, could even begin to contemplate it. Mind, I don't even approve of journalism schools most of the time.
Well, there we are. I mean, that's fair enough, saying your journalism schools perhaps aren't very good at all. Does this sort of worry you at all that India is looking at China for inspiration rather than America or Europe?
I think India is looking at all sorts of places for inspiration, whether it's on journalism, whether it's on agriculture. You know, is this a problem? Or is this? Would we wish that Modi would decide to spend the money on modelling a university after Columbia or after Oxford? Yes, of course we would. But in the bigger scheme of things, this isn't even if he were able to create something that looked like the Chinese journalism school, would it actually thrive? Would it cut down the media in India? It's probably not going to have too much of an impact because media in India is so diverse that I don't think you can shut down the various voices in India in a way that perhaps you are doing in China today.
But isn't it a bit appalling that anybody could conceive of having a university of the media? I just find the whole.
What do you study? You study shorthand and balance, and then that's pretty much it. Okay. On that note, I think we've got a bit of balance there. We will end it. Thank you very much indeed for listening. Midori House was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusta Pacheco and Mike Hewin. The studio manager was Wei Dong Lin. My thanks to Quentin Peel and to Zainia Wickett. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.